This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a rare midsummer order. The court responded to a request from the Justice Department to take up two cases this fall to resolve the confusion sown by a high court ruling issued earlier this year on sentencing guidelines. That ruling, known as the Blakely decision, arose from a challenge to the sentencing system used by courts in Washington state, but similar systems are used in several other states and, most significantly, in federal courts across the country. By some estimates, over 200,000 criminal cases could be affected, and right now nobody knows what the rules are. A couple of weeks ago in Chicago, for example, a federal appeals court rejected the old guidelines. The next day, a federal appeals court in New York upheld them. We'll try to explain how this mess developed, and we'll talk with Deputy Attorney General James Comey and with Douglas Berman, a sentencing expert at Ohio State University. Later in the program, a high-tech test may resolve one of the most controversial questions about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. How many shots were fired in Dealey Plaza? But first, what one former official described as the legal equivalent of a 40-car pileup. You may want to hold off on your phone calls and emails until we've explained this decision and the mess it's caused. Joining us here in Studio 3A is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you, Neil.
As we go into the background of this case, I guess we have to begin with who was Blakely and what did he do?
Well, Ralph Blakely kidnapped his ex-wife, and she was later rescued, unhurt. Under Washington state law, that crime alone would get you about 4 years in prison. But Washington state has sentencing guidelines similar to the federal system. He pled guilty to the kidnapping. The judge then had a hearing and said this was an exceptionally cruel act. He had bound her in duct tape, put her in a wooden coffin in the back of a pickup truck. She probably thought she was going to be killed. And he said, I'm going to impose a 7.5-year sentence on you, Mr. Blakely, because I find this deliberate cruelty in this act calls for a greater sentence. Now, that's a relatively common situation. I mean, I think simply put, in the United States, we sort of understand the fact that prosecutors charge people with a crime, a jury finds somebody guilty of a crime, and then the judge sort of decides what's the proper sentence.
And sometimes that involves a layman might call aggravating circumstances.
Yes. Yes, the judge takes a look at the crime and says, sure, Mr. Smith, you robbed a bank, but you also were carrying a gun. You also took a shot at the teller. You were the mastermind of this bank robbery, so I'm going to give you this enhanced sentence. Well, the Supreme Court said, and has said in several recent decisions, that any fact which increases the penalty for a crime must be found by the jury or must be specifically admitted by the defendant. Now, that's sort of a simple statement, but it's sort of thrown a wrench into the machinery because it calls into question the whole understanding that judges are allowed to decide for themselves these extra sentencing facts that call for a greater sentence. The Blakely case only involved Washington state, but on the day it came down, everybody said, oh my goodness, this is exactly the same system in the federal government. It's going to throw out all the federal sentencing guidelines. And so that's where we are now. The Supreme Court's going to take up two cases on the first Monday in October and, first of all, say, does the Blakely decision also invalidate the federal sentencing guidelines? And then the really hard part is, okay, if so, what? What happens then?
So what are the rules now?
And yes.
I understand, in addition to two different appeals courts finding different ways in the same within a couple of days, on one day you had four different judges in Utah using four different guidelines.
Yes. I mean, it is sort of a mess because there's one sort of view, if you're a judge, to say, well, I shouldn't throw out the federal sentencing guidelines. The Supreme Court didn't say they were deciding the federal sentencing guidelines. But the other judge would say, look, it's almost exactly the same system. The Constitution applies in the federal system and the state system, so I've got to throw out the guidelines. They're unconstitutional. And that's the first part of the mess the Supreme Court has to clear up.
And again, going back to Justice Scalia's opinion on this, as I was looking at it last night, what he said was, these are issues of fact, and in this country, according to our Constitution, issues of fact are to be decided by juries.
Yes, I think there's a good sort of common sense notion to Justice Scalia's opinion. You actually see it a lot in plea bargain cases. I'll go back to Mr. Blakely for a minute. Mr. Blakely, as I say, was charged with kidnapping, and he agreed to plead guilty to this kidnapping. And when he did, the understanding was in the Washington State sentencing guidelines that he'd get 4 years in prison. That's what he understood when he pled guilty. Then he comes into the courtroom, and he emerges with the 7.5-year sentence. And he sort of thinks, well, wait a minute, I didn't agree to that. The same sort of thing happens in juries where, to go back to my bank robbery example, you know, Mr. Smith robs a bank. The jury convicts him of bank robbery. And I'm going to make up the numbers here, but let's say under the federal system, a simple bank robbery might get you 4 or 5 years in prison. That's what you were convicted of. But then the prosecution comes in with all this other evidence that you were the ringleader you were carrying a weapon even though you didn't use it. Anyway, a series of extra factors get ticked on, and you get 16 years in prison. And, you know, you could say to yourself, and I think this is Justice Scalia's point, we really ought to have the jury deciding that rather than let the judge, one person, decide it on his own.
So, should aggravating circumstances be addressed by juries or by judges? If you've served on a jury, if you're a lawyer or a judge, give us a phone call. Is this an opportunity to reform sentencing guidelines? And if so, should that be done by the Supreme Court or by state legislatures and by Congress? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Now, David Savage, some people have said that, there's a simple solution to this, and that's simply to have the bring all those charges into court and have the jury decide all of these essential elements of the case as matters of fact in the trial.
I think that's the way it may turn out, Neil. I think if I had to guess, I think the five justices in the majority are going to hold fast and say that is what we mean. Either you have to charge all these things in the indictment and let the jury decide, did I rob the bank, did I have a gun, did I threaten the teller, all those extra facts, was I the mastermind? The only other option, I think, is to maybe have a post-trial trial, sort of like the way you do in a death penalty case. Somebody is convicted of a murder, then the jury meets again to decide whether this person deserves to get the death penalty based on certain facts.
And I understand that this is the way that state courts do it in Kansas.
Yes, that's right. Kansas is, I think, the only state that sort of moved to in advance try to do what the Supreme Court was saying you should do. Now, I must say there's another polar opposite view, which is that this may end up taking us back to what some people see as the bad old days. That is, the law would say you rob a bank and you can get anywhere from 2 years to 40 years in prison. That's what the maximum penalty be. And then the judge entirely on his own, or her own, decided what the proper punishment is. The sentencing guidelines were trying to get away from that system. But Justice Scalia's opinion seems to suggest that the old bad old days would also be okay, because once you were convicted of bank robbery, you, by law, you could get as much as 40 years, so the judge could choose. So we don't really know how it's going to play out.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. And our first caller is Mark, who joins us from Boston, Massachusetts.
My comment is actually a variety of the bad old days were better than the current situation, and that what the legislators tried to do is reduce judges' discretion by specifying if the judge finds X, Y, or Z, then the sentence is A, B, and C. And I think what the problem is that the legislature has tried to remove judges' authority or ability to use their own judgment without specificity.
Well, David Savage, take us back to the origin of this legislation. It goes back to two strange bedfellows in the United States Senate, and that would have been Strom Thurmond and Edward Kennedy.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the great sort of liberal conservative marriages of convenience. In the early 1980s, Ted Kennedy was concerned that too many poor people, too many minorities got unduly harsh sentences, that the system was sort of biased against poor people and minorities. Strom Thurmond was concerned that there were too many liberal, lenient judges who let people off easy. And everybody sort of agreed there was a great disparity. To take my bank robbery example again, somebody could rob a bank in Baltimore first-time bank robber, and get 3 years in prison. Somebody else could rob the same, a very similar situation in Chicago, and get 30 years in prison because you got a different judge. So the notion that Kennedy and Strom Thurmond came up in the Sentencing Reform Act was to do as Mark alluded to, that is, set a series of specific factors to sort of guide the judge to say bank robbery, carrying a gun, mastermind of the crime, and it would specify a very narrow range. And the idea was you should be punished based on the crime, not sort of based on who the judge is or who you are. But there has been a lot of criticism that the sentencing guidelines are bind judges too much. That, for example, people, particularly a lot of criticism in the drug area, somebody gets arrested with a certain amount of drugs, and the sentences are very stiff, 20, 30 years in prison with no parole. And a lot of people have said judges should have some discretion to say, this, for example, this woman wasn't really a drug dealer. She was carrying these drugs for her boyfriend, and she doesn't deserve a 20-year sentence. In other words, judges have too little discretion now, many people say.
Mm-hmm. Mark, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's get another caller in. This is Kevin, and Kevin's calling from Sacramento, California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Kevin.
Great. I am concerned about these decisions. I've been concerned about sentencing guidelines for a long time. I actually teach criminology in the sociology department at CSU Sacramento. And one thing that I've noticed that it does is it tends to give more power to the prosecutor and take it away from the judge. And I'm afraid that this decision will actually continue this process by giving the prosecutor the power to make these charging decisions.
David Savage?
Well, I think that is a possibility. It is the case that I think Justice Scalia and some of the members of the court don't want judges to have too much discretion. That's certainly the sense of the Blakely opinion, that judges shouldn't be deciding these matters. But if the prosecutors can sort of tick off all these things in the indictment and just get the jury to say yes, the result could be that, as you say, that prosecutors will get more power rather than less.
Yet isn't there a concern that I've read from prosecutors now saying, look, if we've got 13 different things to prove to the jury, they don't like to punish people all that much. It's going to be really hard to prove all these things to, beyond a reasonable doubt, every single point to a jury.
Yes, that's right, Neil. That's why the Justice Department is so worried about this, that they could be left with a situation where they must prove, for example, in the white-collar crime cases, there's a lot of dispute about how much did this fraud actually cost consumers or whatever. It's easy to prove that somebody signed their name to a document that has a falsehood in it, and therefore they could be guilty of a fraud. It's a very complicated thing to say, how much did this fraud cost? And the prosecutors don't want to have to get in the business, as you say, of trying to prove each fact to a unanimous jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Kevin, thanks.
Yeah, I had one more question, and that was
terms 10 seconds.
Of if this does, this process does reduce the discretion of the judge, obviously, and therefore concomitantly increase the power of the prosecutor. I'm wondering, where does the idea of jury nullification fit into this in terms of, well, if the jury then has the power to decide yay or nay on the prosecutor's claims, shouldn't we be talking about jury nullification as well?
I think that's one of the things that David Savage was just talking about.
Yes, we may be juries, maybe just simply say no.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. We're just running out of time in the segment. And David Savage, as always, we appreciate your time.
Good to be with you.
The Supreme Court will hear these two cases in September, hear arguments about them, and then hopefully, from everybody's point of view, unlock the logjam as early as October when their official session begins. When we come back from a short break, U.S. Attorney General James Comey will join us, and more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the confusion in federal sentencing guidelines spawned by a Supreme Court decision this spring. The Supreme Court has now said it will hear two cases and resolve maybe that confusion as soon as this fall. You're invited to join our discussion. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now in Studio 3A is U.S. Deputy Attorney General James Comey. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Neil.
In the brief calling for clarification on this Blakely decision, the one that came out last spring, the Justice Department said the number of criminal cases affected is staggering, an average of 1,200 every week, close to 64,000 a year. How are those cases being handled now?
Well, they're being handled differently in different parts of the country, which is part of the challenge for all participants in the criminal justice system. We've asked our prosecutors to make a number of arguments with sort of fallback positions, like different barricades to retreat to. Ultimately, we're trying to have our prosecutors arrange for the sentencings to be in the alternative so that whichever way the Supreme Court comes out, we don't have to resentence 60,000 defendants.
Mm-hmm. There are several Supreme Court justices, and they're all over the place on this particular matter, but Sandra Day O'Connor has been particularly outspoken about the disappointment that she found in this decision she says has just caused a car wreck.
Well, it certainly caused a lot of confusion throughout the country. Every district, every circuit in the country has had to grapple with this. And it's not just with the prosecutors. The defense lawyers need to understand what the rules are going to be so they can advise their clients. The mm-hmm. clients need to understand the rules so they can decide, as nearly all defendants do in the criminal justice system, when to plead guilty and what to plead guilty to. They need certainty. And the sentencing guidelines offered that. And everybody involved in the system regrets that we don't have that now, which is why we're so glad that the court took this and is going to consider it on an expedited basis.
Is the court the right place for this question to be answered? Isn't this a question for, in terms of the federal courts, the United States Congress?
Well, Congress answered it, as you discussed with your earlier guest, in the early 1980s when they passed the sentencing guidelines. The guidelines survived constitutional challenge then. So Congress has spoken. It's just that the court has issued a decision in the Blakely case that casts some doubt on the viability of that system. So the court, as we've asked them to do, needs to consider it and decide whether the principles in Blakely affect the sentencing guidelines in the federal system.
Mm-hmm. On the face of it, this is not an argument or part of the long-running argument about the length of sentences that are being handed out these days. Some people say they're too long. It's not a question of whether somebody gets a 30-year sentence or a 20-year sentence or a 10-year sentence. It's a question of how we arrive at whatever sentence they get.
That's exactly right. Whether this system of guidelines, which is a very complicated cookbook that drives all federal sentences, survives. And if it does, then people can continue, as they have since 1987 when they started, to debate whether a certain guideline is too high for a certain kind of offense. But you're right. This is about the whole cookbook.
Is this? Do you see this at all as a sort of backdoor attempt at reforming sentences downward?
I don't, because this cuts in different cases different ways. And if the guidelines are stricken, if the cookbook goes away, it will not necessarily inure to the benefit of defendants. Some will get lower sentences, some will get hit much harder, which is the situation we had before 1987.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Brad joins us on the phone from West Palm Beach in Florida.
How's it going, sir?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Actually, I am the bank robber in question he was using in his analogy, having done a federal sentence. I went into a plea agreement, should have gotten somewhere in there between 60 to 80-some-odd months, and was hit with 120 months. Four co-defendants all got in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 months. The judge at sentencing turned around and used enhancements such as ringleader organizer in order to give me four-point upward departure on the federal sentencing guidelines. Since then, I went into prison and did paralegal work for a better part of 10 years and represented numerous people who were on the exact same type of situation. The problem with the federal sentencing guidelines the way they are right now is people go in and they plead out. The prosecution uses it as a tool to encourage pleas. They lure people in with the idea that you're only going to get 50 to 64 months. They come in and they get what they should have actually charged them with in the first place. I'm not arguing innocence or guilt or length of sentence. I'm saying it's a tool that's being used by prosecutors across the country in order to get people to plead to a lesser sentence what they think they're going to go in to get, and then when they actually go in and sentence, they're enhanced well beyond what they thought they were going to get.
You're arguing bait and switch.
Bait and switch, exactly.
Deputy Attorney General?
Well, it's a fair question, and it's a point that I've heard before. I have two reactions. One is that every judge taking a plea and every defense lawyer advising his client tells that client that your sentence will be driven by the sentencing guidelines and nobody can promise you what it is, and there may well be enhancements you haven't anticipated. So everybody goes into that with their eyes open. But beyond that, the pre-1987 period offered the potential for much more stark examples of bait and switch. I was a young federal prosecutor for Rudy Giuliani, who was then the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, and there were two courtrooms in the federal courthouse there where someone could plead to a bank robbery offense or a drug offense, walk into one courtroom and get probation from a judge who was a particularly lenient sentencer, and go next door for the exact same offense and get 30 or 40 years. And you have to ask yourself, is that fair? Is that any better a situation for a pleading defendant where he has total black hole in terms of his sentence?
But what about
I can agree with you on that, but there's one contention between the pre-87 and today is that you had parole then. And even giving somebody a 30-year sentence, they were eligible at their third date, so you're looking at a 10-year sentence, not actually a 30-year sentence for the most part, what they'd really do.
Okay. No, he's right. He's right about that. But there still was striking disparity.
I understand. But
let me bring up, and Brad, thanks very much for the call. Let me bring up Justice Scalia's point. These are issues of fact, ringleader, that sort of thing. Issues of fact ought to be decided by the jury.
Well, this is a very complicated area, one that's frankly probably too complicated for me, but there are ways to distinguish the federal sentencing system from the Washington state system. What the federal system is Congress has directed its agent, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, to set sentences underneath the statutory maximum. So no defendant is going to have his sentence increased beyond what Congress set as the maximum punishment. Washington state was a little different. In Washington state, the finding by the judge of those aggravated factors actually changed the sentence that was dictated by the legislature. So, it's a technical distinction, but we think it is one that we've argued around the country that makes the sentencing guidelines sustainable.
Let's get another caller in, and this will be Janice. Janice is with us from Keyser, Oregon. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Kaiser,
go ahead.
Hi. I kind of see where Justice Scalia is coming from, where he says let the jury decide, on the extras, like the aggravated this or that. But the problem I see is that a lot of jurors don't know enough about law or sentencing. Most people aren't lawyers, so it's kind of hard for them to understand. And in that case, it's being put into the wrong hands, I would think. A judge at least is versed in the laws, and they kind of understand because they see it every day. I would agree that maybe, if the judge said to the jurors, okay, he did this and he was a ringleader and blah, 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 and you give him an extra between 2 and 5 years to the sentence or maybe some guidelines like that, but letting them do it wholly on their own can cause more problems. And then having the prosecutor having to try all the other stuff.
Your cell phone is betraying you, Janice, but let's get a response from the Deputy Attorney
General.
It's
a very good point. If the system has to be Blakeleyized, that is, if the juries have to be instructed and find every sentencing factor, where that will make the biggest difference is in the biggest, most complex cases. We just finished, for example, in New York, the Adelphia trial, where the loss in a very complicated billion-dollar fraud drives the sentence. If a jury has to be instructed upon all the elements of how you find that loss and then have argument on it, jurors will get through it, but it will enormously complicate federal trials.
And lengthen federal trials.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the system's already bogged down so much as it is, it would be bad for everybody. I think all around, taxpayers, jurors, even the people that committed the crime.
Where it makes the biggest difference is with victims of crime. If you imagine a prosecution of a telemarketing fraud on the elderly, the defendant's sentence will be driven by the loss amount, so how much each of those 1,000 old folks lost. Under the Blakely regime, we would have to bring in all 1,000 of those old people from all around the country or all around the world, have the jury hear each of them and find their loss beyond a reasonable doubt, or else the defendant will not get punished for that loss. It cannot be considered. So Blakely doesn't make an enormous difference in a lot of the garden variety cases, but in the bigger, more complex cases, it will drive down sentences, unjustly in our view, and enormously complicated prosecution.
Janice, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Richard. Richard's calling from Mount Pleasant, Utah.
Yes.
Hi.
I'm a practicing attorney, practice in federal and state court, done some prosecution, quite a bit of defense work, and my perception of the present guideline system is that it gives enormous discretion to the prosecutors. They decide what charges to bring. They decide, you know, what they want to bring before court in terms of aggravating factors. And prosecutors, by and large, the assistant U.S. attorneys in the various offices are unelected personnel. They had to convince someone to hire them. They're judged by how, you know, their conviction rates, those types of things. So they have incentive and discretion to heavily affect the sentences, whereas the judges who go through an extensive period of high public scrutiny have little or no discretion. Once the prosecutor puts the charges and the aggravating factors in front of them, the judge, whom we call a judge because we trust his judgment, has little or no say in it, while a new, relatively inexperienced prosecutor trying to make a name for himself can manipulate the sentencing guidelines to get what he wants.
That's a fair point. One of the ways we have tried to address that in the Justice Department is to mandate that all of our prosecutors insist upon charging the most serious readily provable charge and taking a plea to the most serious readily provable charge and bring to the sentencing court's attention all facts that bear on sentencing, because we don't want a situation where a prosecutor is selling a case short in order to get rid of it, hiding from the court drug weights, or not bringing certain counts in order to give a sweetheart deal, just as we don't want people going the other way. What we have instructed our prosecutors to do, and to be fair, we'll never wring all the discretion out of either the prosecutor's role or, frankly, the judge's role. As your caller knows, as a practitioner, there still is a great deal of room for a judge to depart upward or downward in the federal sentencing guidelines. But in an effort to try and address that concern that judges have and practitioners, we have announced a policy across the country that we're going to enforce, that prosecutors have to play it straight as well.
And Richard, thanks for the call. One anticipated effect of the Blakely decision was that plea bargains, as defense attorneys see what might be a temporary opportunity, would go down. Has that in fact happened?
Too early to tell. It's obviously something we're keeping an eye on. I suspect that that plea bargains have, if not ground to a halt, slowed down until everybody can figure out just what the deal is here. Because the defendant might well end up pleading guilty before a judge who decides that Blakely strikes down the federal sentencing guidelines, but he, the judge, wants to give more than they would have. And he's free to once the sentencing guidelines go out. He can give that 30-year sentence, whereas the guidelines might have driven it to a 10-year sentence. So nobody's quite sure which way it cuts, which is why it's so good that the court has granted cert on this matter and is going to provide some guidance.
Is Blakely retroactive? Does it affect all of those sentences that were handed down before Blakely was decided?
Another great question. We don't believe so because the Supreme Court, in a number of related decisions, a case called Apprendi, has concluded that this kind of constitutional decision by the Supreme Court is not retroactive for a variety of technical reasons. But it certainly, that doesn't stop people from filing claims. People are in jail, people who are waiting sentencing. It complicates everybody's life.
We're talking about federal sentencing guidelines. Our guest is James B. Comey, the Deputy Attorney General. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another caller now. Jerry's on the line with us from Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New York, excuse me.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that at least something that ought to enter into these decisions about which path to follow ought to be things like initial crime rates or recidivism rates or things that the criminal justice system is actually supposed to address. I understand that the things we're talking about are building blocks to that, but is there any data on either way of implementing sentences that would suggest a greater good, overall benefit to this question that ought to be considered in these discussions?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's something that we debate about and think about in the criminal justice system all the time, because we don't want to put people in jail just for the sake of putting people in jail. Our goal is deterrence, to incapacitate criminals and to change the crime rate. And the most important statistic I can point you to is that today, crime, including violent crime, is at a 30-year low. It hasn't been this low for at least 30 years. So at a time when people are getting locked up for longer and longer periods of time, the crime rate is going down. Those two, it's like an X if you lay those trends on the same chart. So that's a superficial analysis, but I believe it's a compelling one. Crime is down in large part because criminals are in jail.
Jerry, thank you.
Thank you for the answer.
Okay. Bye-bye. I think we have time for probably one more caller for the Deputy Attorney General Comey. Stephen's with us from Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of like to amplify the callers, Kevin and Richard, from earlier, who talked about prosecutors. As has already been mentioned, they already are seeking the most aggressive, highest charges they can that will bring the highest level of punishment. So it seems when they bring the aggravating causes, that's kind of sneaking other things by the side that they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt, but they think should affect the sentencing. So it seems to me that, unlike Kevin, I think this actually might rein in prosecutors by saying, if you want to bring something in so that if somebody's convicted of a crime, they pay a penalty for it, you've got to prove that they did that thing. Doesn't that seem like a reasonable way to respond?
Well, it's one way to respond, and some courts have interpreted the Blakely decision to dictate that kind of result. We call that Blakelyizing the system. From the government's perspective, that is not a just result because it tends to cut always in favor of reduced sentences. The government loses the ability under that sort of system for any kind of upward departure. The government loses the ability for the district judge to consider in imposing punishment whether the person lied at trial or tried to obstruct justice.
But if they lied at trial or obstructed justice, then bring charges of perjury against them.
Right, and then you have to retry the entire case.
But remember, we're talking about the state bringing charges against citizens. It always is the state's job to prove itself before it incarcerates and punishes citizens. It simply can't do it because it decides we don't like this guy. We have to prove the case.
You sound just like Justice Scalia.
Well, and he's exactly right. But the question is, prove what? And what does the Constitution...
Prove perjury in the example you suggested.
Well, the question is, what does the Constitution require? And is it constitutionally flawed to have a system...
Yeah, a reasonable doubt.
Stephen, would you let him answer, please?
Yes.
Constitutionally flawed to have a system where a judge makes a finding within the statutory maximum that has been laid out by Congress. People ought to be careful what they wish for, because Congress could react to this decision by imposing a vast array of mandatory minimum sentences, pegging every sentence to the statutory maximum, just as it was in colonial times. There weren't a lot of options for felonies. Peg every felony at 40 years and then propose a regime under which a judge could reduce the sentence.
So if Blakely is upheld by the Supreme Court or something like it after it hears these cases come the fall, as you suggest, Congress may rewrite the law.
Well, it's certainly one option. It's a law that Congress has carefully considered. As you said, it had and continues to have strong bipartisan support. All points of the political spectrum in Congress supported the sentencing guidelines. As a young prosecutor, I wasn't too wild about them until I spent 15 years working under them and realized they actually do bring about a just result.
Stephen, we appreciate the phone call. A good debate. When we come back, and we appreciate the time today of Deputy Attorney General James Comey, we thank you very much for joining us today. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking with Douglas Berman, an expert on criminal sentencing at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State. So stay with us for that. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the program, an update on the terror alerts in Washington, D.C., Newark, New Jersey, and New York City, what they mean for the rest of the country. Today, we're talking about federal sentencing guidelines and two cases that will come up before the Supreme Court to resolve a mess the Supreme Court spawned by a decision earlier this year. Joining us now is Douglas Berman, sentencing expert and law professor at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. He joins us from the studios of member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Very good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
I hope you had a chance to hear Deputy Attorney General James Comey was with us in the previous segment. I wondered, did he present a fair summary of this to your mind?
I think he did a very good job. The one point that I'd be inclined to follow up on was a question you asked about, are some of these rulings about the substance of federal sentencing rather than just the procedure? Technically, that the Deputy Attorney General was right that we're talking about how sentences are arrived at rather than what the sentence result ultimately would be. But I think one aspect of why this has become so messy, I think Deputy Attorney General described the guidelines as something of a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a nice metaphor. One thing that everyone should know for sure is it's a 500-page cookbook, and so it's hardly a simple cookbook, and many judges, I think, around the country are quite ready to toss the cookbook in the trash, so to speak, because the recipes seem much too complicated and they don't like the taste of the food that comes out afterwards. And so in some sense, I think it's wrong to tell the story as not practically, if not technically legally, reflecting some dissatisfaction with the length and nature of sentences in the federal system.
And we're getting some squawks on the line between here and Ohio. We apologize to the listeners for those, but I hope you'll bear with us. We'll work on eliminating them, but we want to go ahead with the conversation. So do you see this as a backdoor effort towards reform?
I wouldn't say it's a backdoor effort in the sense that I'm not sure anyone thinks they're sort of sneaking something in. I do think it reflects the justices, or at least five of the nine, ultimately concluding that the way we've been putting these sentencing rules together have enough problems that they're comfortable saying there's got to be a different way, there's got to be a better way. And one point that I'd add to the equation that I think is very important is the decision is not just about do judges or juries find the facts that influence sentences, but also the standard of proof that's going to be used. And I think this is the part that is most surprising. Not only under the current guidelines do judges find the facts, but they're only required to find it by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the fancy legal term for saying more likely than not. And so there are lots of cases across the country over the last 15 years applying these guidelines where judges will say, gosh, if I had to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, I might not increase the sentence, but this cookbook tells me I'm only supposed to decide whether it's more likely than not. And hearing the prosecutor, hearing the defense, well, I think it's more likely than not, and so I have no choice but to increase the sentence based on that. And the Blakely decision seems to be saying that in the federal system, that can no longer prevail.
Tell us a little bit about these two cases. The Deputy Attorney General, for obvious reasons, could not discuss them, but tell us a little bit about the two cases that are going to be up for review before the Supreme Court on this fast track.
They both involve drug offenses, and that's not uncommon. About 40% of the federal convictions are drug offenses, and they're important not only because of a variety of debates over whether we're using incarceration in the war on drugs, but also because under the federal system, the amount of drugs involved are critically important to what the ultimate sentence is. And so these drug cases have been in many ways very prime examples of sort of the problem of, at least perceived by some, the way the old rules worked. The defendant would plead guilty. More often than not, actually 97% of all cases in the federal system involve guilty pleas rather than trials. So in the vast majority of the cases, the defendant would plead guilty, but plead guilty only to being involved in a drug conspiracy. And then the judge would find how much was involved in that drug conspiracy and also the other factors you were talking about before, mm-hmm. whether the person was a ringleader, whether there was some violence involved, things of that nature. And that could radically increase the amount of the sentence. And so drug cases are useful vehicles for the court to be looking at because not just in the cases they'll have in front of them, but in cases nationwide over the last 15 years, the amount of drugs that judges have found by a preponderance of the evidence has had a profound impact on the actual sentences that defendants were given.
What about the attorney, Deputy Attorney General's, one of his last points that he made of those who say that this is unfair, that juries should decide these facts, and that absolutely, if you're going to make these cases, judges shouldn't be deciding these things. Be careful what you ask for, is what he said, that legislatures may respond to this, and we've certainly seen a lot of cases of a lot of people, a lot of politicians running get tough on crime.
I think that's a very real risk. And one of the broader questions for those of us who study this area is to try to figure out what's the best institution to write up these rules and then apply these rules. And one of the things that I think shouldn't get left out of the equation is the development of sentencing commissions as a unique body that can be insulated somewhat from the political dynamics that may drive legislatures to increase sentences. And one of the unfortunate stories in the federal system, from my perspective, is that the Federal Sentencing Commission, which was this body that was created as part of this broad reform effort 20 years ago, has not taken the lead in saying that perhaps the sentences are getting too long, or actually it's a bit more complicated than that. They have in various times said there are problems with the way Congress is pushing sentences tougher and tougher, but Congress doesn't want to hear that too often. And so I think it's absolutely a big concern that legislatures will respond to this decision by simply finding ways to make sentences tougher. But I think
and judges' options even fewer.
That's right, exactly. But I hope that sentencing commissions will play a very robust role in figuring this out. And one thing that I'm watching out for example, is the state of Minnesota this week has their sentencing commission about to issue a report to try to figure out what Blakely means in their state. And so another thing that's worth sort of knowing, this is a 40-car pileup, not just in the federal system, but in really every state across the country, or at least those that have been experimenting guideline sentencing reform. And we're seeing different kinds of reactions. In the state of Tennessee, for example, the governor appointed a task force to try to think through, and to the governor's credit, didn't just put prosecutors on the task force, but also put defense attorneys, also some law professors as ex officio members. And so there's an effort, I think, across the country to figure out not only what should the new rules be, but who should be integrally involved in developing those new rules.
I guess we'll be revisiting this issue when the Supreme Court hears arguments in these two cases as early as September, I guess, and then when they reveal their decision later in the fall. Professor Berman, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Douglas Berman, a law professor at Ohio State University, and he joined us from member station WOSU in Columbus, Ohio.